From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at Wisconsin's incarceration rate, which has plummeted during the pandemic and is now at its lowest point in two decades. Sean Wilson, ACLU's statewide manager for Smart Justice, shares his vision for restorative justice after being incarcerated as a teenager.
Given that I experienced dehumanization throughout the 17 years of my incarceration, and I witnessed it perpetrated against my fellow captives, I really believe this current system needs to go.
Then we learn about the Bradley Corporation, a 100-year-old Wisconsin company founded on an invention that allowed multiple people to wash their hands at once.
Shockingly, that same wash fountain with only just minor modernization improvements is still sold today.
Plus, learn about the infamous KK can opener and the road construction that could put it on a diet. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, the ACLU's statewide manager for Smart Justice shares his vision for restorative justice after serving 17 years as a teenager. We learn about the Bradley Corporation, a Wisconsin company founded on hand-washing innovation 100 years ago. Plus, learn potential plans to make a Southside overpass known as the KK can opener a bit safer. We'll start with this. Incarceration rates have plummeted in Wisconsin since the beginning of the pandemic. The state's prison and jail population is now at its lowest point of the century, with less than 30,000 people in custody. The lower number of inmates could translate to big savings for state and local governments that have been struggling with the weight of the pandemic. But are these losses sustainable, or are they likely to rebound once the pandemic subsides? The Wisconsin Policy Forum explores those questions in their latest report about the state's inmate population. Ari Brown is a researcher with the forum, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the report.
Thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the numbers. How much has Wisconsin's prison population declined since the beginning of the pandemic?
Sure. So in this report, we looked both at state prisons and local jails. So we found that the state prison population from the end of February 2020 to the end of February 2021 dropped by about 16%. The population drop in local jails was even more pronounced. That data is from April. So looking from before the pandemic to April 2020, a month into the pandemic, there was a 35% drop, which was kind of the most accentuated drop. But in general, both populations are very much below where they have generally been over the course of the 21st century. Population numbers that really haven't been seen with state prisons, at least since 1999 or 2000. And then local jails as far back as we have data, which is about 2003. So the pandemic has really assisted in getting these populations to a much lower level than they have been in recent memory.
It seems like, according to your report, it's in part due to the pandemic and in part due to some other factors. I'd like to get to that in just a moment. But I'm interested, what does the decline look like specifically in Milwaukee?
Yeah, so in Milwaukee, the declines have looked similar to what's been going on at the state level. Looking specifically at local jails, the April 2019 to April 2020 drop was about 39%, so actually a little bit larger than the overall statewide drop. So in December 2020, which is the most recent local jail data we have, the population was just under 1,400, whereas for most of 2019, it kind of fluctuated between 1,800 and 2,100, so pretty significantly below where it has been. And even in the kind of greater Southeast Wisconsin area, most counties have seen declines very similar to what's being seen in Milwaukee of about 35 to 40%. So it's not just Milwaukee County, but also, you know, Racine County, Kenosha County, and then the Wow counties as well.
Now, I think some people hear declining prison populations and they think to themselves, well, are these people who should have been in prison, who should be in prison now? And I think that really speaks to the policies that have been put in place. This wasn't all due to the pandemic, it seems. What are some of the policies that are responsible for this decline?
Right. As you mentioned, it's kind of a combination of things. So for state prisons, a lot of it from the experts that we talked to in writing this report, there seems to be a lot attributed to, because state prisons generally house those who have committed more serious crimes and are generally going to be in custody of the state for longer than a year, those, you know, individuals usually have to go through a longer trial process. And just because of the pandemic, there has been a significant slowdown in the processing of these cases. So partially, you know, just general pandemic effects, but also partially just cases not being processed to the same extent that they were in 2019. For local jails, there's kind of a lot going on. So the trends that you see in state prisons is kind of, since the pandemic started, a kind of gradual decline in the population. Whereas in local jails, there was a big drop off in April and May of 2020. And then by the end of the summer, the population was starting to kind of creep back upwards and has not seen that same decline really since April and May. So that kind of big drop is attributable to a couple of things. First, because local jails tend to house those who have committed less serious crimes and those who are serving short sentences, there was a shift, a push at the beginning of the pandemic to try to safely release as many, you know, individuals as possible to get to the place where local jails could follow, you know, COVID, you know, social distancing guidelines, maybe those with like very little time left in their sentence, or those who could easily go to something like electronic monitoring, or could be released on a signature bond. But you actually were in certain places starting to see some declines happening even before the pandemic started. And the experts that we talked to attribute it to those same kinds of things like signature bonds, things like electronic monitoring, just trying to get, you know, individuals out of local jails to try to reduce like overcrowding and things like that, even when the pandemic was not a concern. And since that time, all of those things have only been accelerated to the point where now there's a real effort to kind of look into how those things might be deployed in the future. Some of the impact at the local jail, some of the reason that potentially some of those populations are starting to creep back up is that because the state prisons can't process their cases, some of those individuals who will eventually end up in a state prison are currently being held in a local jail. And we believe that that data is being counted as part of the local jail population. So not all of those currently in local jails are, you know, that's their final in custody place. A lot of those individuals will end up in state prison. It's just currently they're awaiting their trial and their processing.
As you mentioned, we saw these numbers recover a bit in the latter half of last year, at least in jails. Is that a trend we see continuing after the pandemic subsides? Is this just a momentary decrease in prison populations?
That's one thing that we talk quite a bit about in our piece. And I think it's kind of the central motivating question for, you know, county corrections leaders going forward is, are the declines that we saw right at the beginning of the pandemic sustainable? Do counties want to sustain them? And if they are going to be sustainable, what kind of measures and policies are county leaders going to enact to make sure that's the case? You know, in conversations that we had with local leaders, one of the things that kept coming up was that even before the pandemic, there was kind of more attention being paid to what kind of policies can we enact to make sure that we are holding individuals for either as little time as possible, or we are preventing overcrowding, kind of generally things in that policy space. And, you know, to the extent that that is going to be replicated, it's both going to be a question of, do Wisconsin residents want it? Do county leaders want it? And if that is the case, what kind of individual policies are going to be enacted going forward that are going to make that a reality, like sustainable over a long-term period?
Yeah. A part of this conversation that we really haven't touched on yet, fewer people in prison means we're needing to spend less money to support these facilities, to support the people who live in these facilities. Your research looks at how much money Wisconsin and its local governments spend on their Department of Corrections, on prisons and jails, compared to the national average. How do we stack up?
So generally, we're very close to the national average. There are certain things, certain policy areas that Wisconsin differs heavily from the national average. This is not one of them, especially with local corrections. We're very, very close to the national average. In 2017, which is the most recent spending data that we have, the state of Wisconsin was generally slightly above, I think we say about 12.9% higher than state governments nationwide in terms of spending on corrections. Local governments were a little bit lower than the local government national average. But in general, one thing that I think you can kind of notice going through our piece, and figure three is kind of the one in our piece that points this out, is that over time, even adjusting for inflation, we are spending a lot more now than we did, you know, 40, 50 years ago when it comes to corrections. And this isn't just the case in Wisconsin, but it's the case everywhere. Our spending, even when adjusted for inflation, our spending on corrections has multiplied by a factor of three or four in some cases, both at the state level and at the local level. One of the things that prompted us doing this research in the first place was that last summer, we kind of took a critical look at how much Wisconsin and then the nation was spending on police as that kind of became, you know, part of the national discourse. And then earlier, you know, about a month ago, we were kind of in the throes of the state budget discussion. And combining those two things, we kind of thought another natural place to look would be how much we're spending on corrections. And this piece actually initially started just as being a piece about how much we were spending on corrections, and we ended up getting really good population data. But we thought it was noteworthy to kind of point out that this trend of beating inflation by quite a bit in terms of, you know, over time how much we're spending on corrections is not really something that you see in most other policy areas. Even in the police piece that we did last summer, that's another, you know, area that we're spending over time. We're kind of beating inflation in terms of how much we're spending, but certainly not to the extent that we're seeing it with corrections. And it's not only compared to itself over time, but also compared to other kind of budget items. Corrections has really become a priority over the last couple of decades. So we're now at this kind of very critical juncture where you have the state budget conversation is happening. You have massive stimulus bills being enacted. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we're starting to move out of the pandemic. And it's going to be a real juncture where state and local leaders are going to be able to take a look at their budgets and say, what should we prioritize going forwards? And seeing the kind of spending trends with corrections and how big of a priority that has become over time, simultaneously with these populations being reduced by quite a bit, I think it's going to present state and local leaders with a real opportunity to say, is this something we want to continue in terms of the level of spending? And if so, how is that money going to be spent? Could we, you know, look into other ways to spend money on corrections that would keep populations down? And is that something that we want to do? Unfortunately, with the data, the spending data that we have, it's as of 2017, and I think maybe some of it is 2018. So we can't really say what is going on in terms of spending since the pandemic has started. But once that data starts to come out, I think it's going to be really interesting to take a look and say, you know, as we were dropping our populations by 15, 20, 30%, was spending doing the same thing? And what we kind of theorize in this report is that it's probably not the case that spending was dropping to the same extent that populations were, just because a lot of spending on corrections is fixed costs. You need to have, you know, employees hired. Food and health services are absolutely critical. And especially, you know, the money that was being spent to kind of keep up with COVID regulations, we imagine was probably quite significant. So it's very likely that you were not seeing nearly the spending declines that you were seeing, and to kind of parallel the population declines. Hmm.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about this story as we get more of those numbers and kind of figure out where we are right now in the future. But Ari Brown, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Ari Brown is a researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find a link to the forum's report on Wisconsin's declining incarceration rates at WUWM.com. Sean Wilson was only 17 years old when he was convicted of armed robbery and sentenced to 17 years in prison here in Wisconsin. From there, he began the long journey of accepting responsibility for his actions and repairing the harm he created. From within the walls of the Green Bay Correctional Institution, he became an advocate for restorative justice, and he took that work outside of prison when he was released. Wilson now uses his experience in the system to push for new ideas of justice in the state. He works at the ACLU of Wisconsin as the manager for their Smart Justice campaign. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi spoke with Wilson about his story and how it shaped his vision for justice.
The current justice system that we as Americans are faced with now is a justice system that is punitive. Where I would love to see us go is one that is restorative. Most of the folks who are in our nation's jails and prisons suffer from some form of substance abuse. Some of them have mental health issues. Some of them are experiencing a great deal of trauma. Folks are hurting. And as we frequently hear, hurt people hurt people. Addiction drives us to do things that we wouldn't normally do in our right mind. And so the response currently is lock them up, throw away the key, and we'll deal with them once they reenter society. And folks are being sent into these facilities that are not equipped to address trauma, to address substance abuse, to address mental health illness. And so what is happening is we're putting a Band-Aid on major social issues. And so folks come home from prison or jail, not quote unquote rehabilitated, not quote unquote reformed, not quote unquote healed. They come home trying to figure out how they're going to reintegrate and deal with the stigma of incarceration. And so we're working nationally as well as locally to transform our justice system for all of the reasons that I just mentioned. I was driven and encouraged to do this work. You may be skeptical, but I was inspired to do this work at sentencing. When the judge looked at me and said to me, "Mr. Wilson, you will be able to rejoin our society in your mid-30s. There was a shriek in the courtroom, and I looked back and I saw my uncles carrying my mom out of the courtroom because she was crying so uncontrollably. And I said in that moment, these white folks are going to hate they gave me this much time to think. And I said these white folks because as I looked all around the courtroom, all I saw was white folks. And I didn't understand what that epiphany or what that subconscious statement meant at the time. I didn't begin to understand what that meant until I found myself within the confines of the Department of Corrections witnessing the inhumanity that was perpetrated against the folks in their care. And it was in the confines of the Department of Corrections that I just buried myself in books, that I began to do a great deal of healing internally, that I began on a spiritual quest, that I began to accept responsibility for my actions and understand that I hurt someone, and I needed to begin a restorative process of repairing that harm. And ultimately, I came home and I hit the ground running because I got out of prison before I got out of prison. And what I mean by that is I got out of prison mentally before I got out physically. And so that's what made my transition pretty easy, coupled with family support.
So I want to take you back to the day that you were sentenced to 17 years in prison. And, you know, thinking about the journey that you've come on since then and thinking about restorative justice, if instead of handing you a 17-year sentence, the judge would have offered you some sort of treatment program or model for healing for yourself and the people that you harmed, what would that have looked like?
In restorative justice, there is something called harm needs. And basically what that means is what is needed to restore the harm of the victim and what is needed to restore the harm of the perpetrator. What caused this individual to perpetrate this harm and what is it going to take to repair the harm to the victim? And so if I was the judge, I would have looked at this young man who was sitting in front of me as a 17-year-old kid. I would have looked at his family dynamics. I would have looked at his schooling, and I would have allowed that to inform whether or not I should send this young man away for the same amount of time he has spent on this earth. And so in my case, I was raised by my grandmother, middle class upbringing, was able to go and spend time with my mother, who lived in the 53206 zip code during the summer months. And it was during that time when I began to give in to peer pressure, make poor decisions. So I would have looked at all of these things, and I wouldn't have concluded that this young man needs to be sent to prison for 17 years. Did accountability need to be had? Absolutely. Did that accountability need to be 17 years in prison? Absolutely not. If anything, it would have been no more than a year, 2 years, and it may could have been converted into community service.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're a long ways from incorporating restorative justice into our criminal legal system on a grand scale. But it strikes me that not only do we need policy changes to incorporate restorative justice, but we also need like a radical rethinking of justice in the first place. Because if we're talking about victims and what they want out of justice and what justice means to them, we're talking about a shift in their thinking as well. And I'm just curious, after, you know, spending 17 years in prison, what justice means to you?
It means restoration. It means repairing harm and rebuilding community. That's what justice means to me. I think if judges were to apply restorative justice principles in their court, it would be transformational. Currently, what happens, a case is adjudicated, the perpetrator is sent away to languish in a prison cell, and the victim is sent away to deal with the trauma that has just been perpetrated upon them. Justice, to me, in this moment, will be restorative.
Do you think there's any place for incarceration as a form of justice?
Well, I am somewhat of an abolitionist, and I believe that the current criminal legal system is a reincarnation or an evolution of chattel slavery as a result of the 13th Amendment saying that slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist except as a punishment for a crime. And so I like to say that I come from the loins of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. These are the folks that I descend from, and they were abolitionists. They were all about abolishing a system that had taken a whole group of people and dehumanized them. And so given that I experienced dehumanization throughout the 17 years of my incarceration, and I witnessed it perpetrated against my fellow captives, I really believe this current system needs to go.
Yeah.
Just to be honest, I really believe that it needs to go. Its foundation is racist. Anything that has racism as its foundation needs to be uprooted and started from scratch.
Yeah. I want to talk about language and the power of words. I've heard you refer to the criminal legal system, and a lot of people in this realm talk about the criminal justice system. And I want to ask you what the difference is between these words, and why do you choose to use the term criminal legal system?
So slavery was wrong, but it was legal. This so-called criminal justice system is not handing out justice. Giving a 17-year-old kid 17 years in a state prison, that's not justice. Placing me in an environment with adults as a teenager, that's not justice. You place me in an environment that was rife with violence, where I could have been taken advantage of as a kid, and it's just not right. And we always talking about, what does the science say? Where's the evidence? Well, the evidence tells us that young people should not be treated the same as adults. And we are doing that here in this state. We are one of three that still charges 17-year-olds as adults. We are paying over $200,000 to incarcerate young people. We won't even spend that amount of money on their education, but we're willing, and it's okay for us to spend that amount to put them in prison. Like, come on, what sense does that make? That doesn't even add up.
Yeah. So we're talking about really revolutionary changes in what you want a justice system to look like. But right now, you know, as we have people in prison in this state who are suffering from the coronavirus at crazy rates, what is the top priority and focus for you right now in your work?
So right now, in our work, we're focused on the Joint Finance Committee hearings that are coming up. The first one will be April 9th at UW-Whitewater. And so what we've been doing is we've been training folks statewide to understand the budget process, and not only to understand the budget process, but to understand how the budget is a moral document and how it affects their lives and why it's important for them to come out and participate in person and share in the 2 minutes that our legislators are allotting us why this budget matters to us and what we would like to see our tax dollars allocated to. And so the governor has put some grand proposals in his budget that we believe will move the criminal legal system forward. I mean, it's not a budget that we would have written, but we can get on board with a lot of the proposals because we believe that it will have a significant impact. And I'm hoping that our elected officials will put aside their political ideologies and put the people of Wisconsin front and center and understand that we are a outlier state in this region as it relates to our over-reliance on incarceration, that we're spending more on incarceration than we spend on our entire UW system, that we're spending $38,000 a year to incarcerate one adult man or woman, that we're spending over $200,000 to incarcerate a young person. And so we're encouraging folks to come out and testify in person if they're comfortable. And we're encouraging folks to let our elected officials know that this budget matters. And not only does this budget matters, but the things that the governor is proposing are things that should be supported in a bipartisan manner, and not to let partisanship get in the way of moving our state forward. And so that's what we're working on right now. For the next month or two, we're going to be all hands on deck. But besides that, the ACLU of Wisconsin's Campaign for Smart Justice is working to reduce the jail and prison population and fight racism in the criminal legal system. Here in Wisconsin, we are sending over 3,000 people back to prison each year for technical violations. This is a cost to taxpayers of over $200 million. The human cost is incalculable. Families and communities are being disrupted. So we're asking that the legislature take this up and end this practice legislatively because it's more sustainable. The DOC has changed their policies administratively. We don't know the impact, and we won't know the impact of those changes for another 3 to 6 months. And so we are reserving our applause until then.
Thank you, Sean, for the work that you're doing with the ACLU and for sharing your story on Lake Effect. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate you, and I appreciate this conversation. And I hope that your listeners also appreciate it and got some from it, because this is a collaborative effort. That's the only way we're going to bring about transformational change, is with all hands on deck.
Sean Wilson is the ACLU of Wisconsin's Smart Justice Campaign Manager. Wilson mentioned the public hearing for comment on the governor's biennial budget. That hearing is on Friday, April 9th in Whitewater. You can find out more information at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about Milwaukee's infamous KK can opener and the new construction that could dampen its reign of terror.
It is actually one of these goofy Milwaukee things that if you just mention the words KK can opener, eyes will light up.
We'll learn more from Milwaukee Records Matt Wild in about 15 minutes. But first, we learn about a 100-year-old Wisconsin company that was founded with a signature wash fountain. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Hygiene and hand washing have been more important than ever in the time of coronavirus. But you might not think too much about the equipment used to wash our hands outside of its functionality. The Bradley Corporation, founded 100 years ago in Milwaukee, was founded on the idea to help people wash better. Today, they make a multitude of bathroom technologies, but it all started with their iconic circular wash fountain that allows multiple people to wash their hands at the same time. To learn more about the company's history and how hygiene innovation has been impacted by the pandemic, I'm joined by John Domasi, Director of Global Strategy and Corporate Development at the Bradley Corporation. He starts by explaining how their circular wash fountain actually came out of solving a company need at Allen Bradley.
Harry Bradley, who was one of the owners of Allen Bradley, who was always inventing things, realized that his employees on the shop floor were taking so much time of their lunch breaks standing in lines to wash their hands. And he felt really bad that those employees were taking, you know, 10 minutes of their 30-minute break just waiting to wash their hands. So he said there had to be a better way. So he solved that problem by making a circular wash fountain that allowed multiple employees on the shop floor to wash their hands at the same time. And not only did that save time and the employees loved it, but it also saved water, saved space. And he saw, wow, I made a better mousetrap. You know, so how it actually came to be more than just a great idea at a single company was that other company leaders who would tour Allen Bradley, they'd like Allen Bradley's normal products, but they go, wow, where did you get that wash fountain in the middle of your shop floor there? That's incredible. And they wanted to purchase those as well. And he said, well, we don't sell those. I just, you know, made those prototypes to help my own employees. Well, one by one, the word got out about these wash fountains, and two local investors, one of them being by the name of Howard A. Mullett, said, well, if you're not going to sell these yourself, we would love to really make a company of this because we're just so, you know, fascinated by this. We think this has a lot of legs to it, you know, to go. So they purchased the patent from Harry Bradley, and out of respect for him, named the company Bradley Wash Fountain Company. And that was back in 1921. So it was a great idea. And shockingly, that same wash fountain with only just minor modernization improvements is still sold today and is sold around the world.
I had one of those wash fountains at my grade school and middle school. And, you know, when I was a kid, it like made going to the bathroom so much fun because you could hit the foot pedal and, you know, it was like this big group activity you could do. And I, of course, had no idea it was a Wisconsin product, of course, but reading up on the history here, it just makes it all a bit more special with that connection. And as you mentioned, this company was founded on the concept of making hand washing a smoother process and taking out those points of contact. And now, of course, in our world of dealing with a pandemic and life post-pandemic down the road, do you think these kinds of designs will just be more standard and widely incorporated due to just how much we have thought about hygiene in recent history?
Very much so. What has happened, and this certainly didn't happen just because of COVID, but in the past 20, 30 years, Bradley has really been looked at as an industry expert in commercial hand washing, commercial bathrooms. For the last 10 years or so, we've been doing a proprietary study with 1,000 users of public bathrooms each year. So we're an industry expert in how people use it, what their expectations are, the cleanliness expectations. And obviously, like you said, from COVID, obviously all of that expanded dramatically in a very short amount of time. So touchless sinks, touchless faucets, touchless soap dispensers, things like that, have been growing every year, you know, long before COVID. But now the impact of COVID is going to be like how 9/11 was on airport travel. COVID is going to be for commercial building design. And it is permanently going to impact commercial building design and especially commercial washrooms in all those buildings.
So, of course, you mentioned no-touch fixtures. What other changes are here to stay?
Well, there's, in our survey, we do get input on this. It isn't just no-touch fixtures. It's better ways of entering bathrooms. Sure, like at airports, you've seen that they're doorless and they have something called a corridor concept where you have kind of like an S pattern that you go into. A lot more companies are considering that. A lot of companies are looking at touch-free flushers. The more that you can make everything no touch, the better it's going to be. There's a lot more considerations now for foot entry and exits on doors. I'm sure you've seen some of those where you can just pull a little latch on the bottom of the door and kind of, you know, just pull it open with your foot. A lot more of those things are going to happen. And the specifications right now that are going through architects and engineers are dramatic. So even all the projects that were happening in stadiums, convention halls, schools, government facilities, all of those last year are, hey, hold on, I think we're going to have some changes to that. And almost every specification that I see is all has significantly enhanced touch-free elements on it now.
So that's a lot of concentrating on hand washing, but what about hand drying? You know, before the pandemic, the debate of air dryers versus paper towel and the waste paper towel can have comes to mind. So is there more information or improved science of sanitation in this debate?
Well, we do research on that as well, too. We offer both. We offer many different types of paper towel dispensers and many styles of dryers. And we do that because both of them have a very specific need in the commercial washroom. Both of them will continue to have that. From the sustainability standpoint, dryers are going to continue to grow in acceptance. Many companies are moving totally to a dryer type environment as the noise level of dryers, you know, the motors and dryers continue to be quieter and quieter as time goes on. You're going to see more dryers come online. From the paper towel standpoint, they are going to continue to play a role, even though, just like you said, there's certainly the waste element that you have to deal with on that, but especially during the COVID time and going forward, a lot of people use the paper towel not only to dry their hands, but also to open up a door. And there's definitely a lot of research that's gone on that, again, going forward, I think you're going to see dryers will be a higher percentage than they are today, but you are definitely still going to see the paper towel dispenser because it plays an important role beyond just drying your hands.
On that note, is there a rise in antimicrobial materials, whether that be for stall handles or even surfaces of sinks?
Yes, there is an increase in antimicrobial materials themselves, antimicrobial properties, even if it isn't fully antimicrobial. And the most important is just easy to clean surfaces. Prior to COVID, especially in higher-end hotels, restaurants, resorts, even some office buildings, you'd see very ornate, rough surfaced type of decks and sink systems and things like that, because aesthetically it was very appealing. Those are not easy to clean, and there is definitely going to be a dramatic change in that, because the speed of cleaning, the ability to truly fully clean a surface, is so much more important today than it was in 2019, that you are going to see material experts continue to come out with very aesthetically pleasing materials, but all of them will need to have some type of easy to clean capabilities and probably the ability to withstand a lot more cleansers and materials and things like that without bleaching their surfaces. So antimicrobial will continue to increase, as well as easy to clean designs.
Now, Bradley was established right here in Milwaukee, and it's now based in Menominee Falls and also has a plant in Germantown. So very much has stayed here in Wisconsin. But one other thing that stands out in your company history is Elizabeth Wetherell, the first female president of a Wisconsin company. Can you share more about her and her legacy?
Yes, Elizabeth Wetherell actually started as a administrative person in Bradley when I believe there was only 20 people total in the whole company. And quite a story. She just very hardworking, very intelligent, very dedicated. And through different war times and things like that, she continued to rise to the occasion, was counted on for more and more responsibility. And in 1942, which was obviously right in the middle of that real trying time in the United States, Elizabeth Wetherell was promoted as the president of Bradley. And she didn't know it at the time, but she was going to be the very first female president of any Wisconsin company at that time. So she really paved the road for a lot of people in Wisconsin. She was it was amazing. We went through all the archives, you know, with it being the 100th anniversary. And there's not a lot of pictures. She wasn't one to have big presentations and things like that in front of all the employees. She was definitely someone who led from behind, a very quiet, humble leader, but one that was very effective and got the company through a very rough time in our country's history.
As the company celebrates 100 years, how do you think remaining in Wisconsin has been a strength?
The Mullett family, we're in our fifth generation of ownership now. They have been just unrelenting in their commitment to the Milwaukee area, to Wisconsin, and made in the USA. We certainly get a very small percentage of our products overseas and, you know, other areas outside of the Midwest. But any opportunity that we have to source materials in the Midwest, source materials in the United States, continue to build our labor force in the Wisconsin area, that has always been a very important priority for the Mullett family. And we have very dedicated employees. I've been at Bradley 25 years. I am by no means even close to so many people that have been at Bradley for, you know, 30, 40, 45, 50 years at Bradley. And I think it's that commitment and dedication that the ownership family has that really resonates with the employees. And that's going to continue for generations to come.
John Domasy is the Director of Global Strategy and Corporate Development at the Bradley Corporation, based here in Wisconsin. The company is celebrating 100 years, and you can see photos of the first wash fountain at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we learn about the KK can opener's impending road diet that could bring its glory days of destruction to an end. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Picture it. You're driving a semi down First Street in Walker's Point. As you near Bayview, the street becomes kinnikinick, and you see an overpass carrying the Canadian Pacific Railroad. Then you hit it. That overpass? Yeah, you hit it. And suddenly you've become the most recent victim of the infamous KK can opener. The overpass has become an icon of destruction in Milwaukee. But its glory days may be coming to an end. Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild recently wrote about it, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the KK can opener and its impending diet.
Well, Matt Wild, thank you again for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's good to be back again.
For the uninitiated, how would you describe the KK can opener?
I would describe it as a Milwaukee folktale that has been told down from generation to generation that grandparents scare their children with it. No, it is actually one of these goofy Milwaukee things that if you just mention the words KK can opener, eyes will light up. People will be like, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's actually two bridges. It's a series of bridges as you're entering Bayview, kind of between Walker's Point and Bayview, that are a little low. And from time to time, or actually quite often, a big semi will just get stuck under these bridges or just kind of shear the top of these trucks clean off. And it's happened so often that people have given it a name, and it is the cleverly titled KK Can Opener.
What's funny is there's even a Facebook page dedicated to the KK Can Opener. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, there really ought to be Facebook pages and Twitter accounts set up for all these things, you know, like the Miller Park Bat and, I don't know, the Milwaukee Lion. They all have their own little social media accounts, and as does the KK Can Opener. And I get a kick out of it because the Facebook page, I don't know who runs it. God bless them, who's ever doing that. But it kind of imagines these bridges as this conscious being that is literally eating these trucks for lunch. It's just eating these things. It can't wait to just open its giant gaping maw and shave off the top of these trucks as they unwittingly pass underneath those bridges. Like I said, God bless whoever's behind that.
It is kind of this public menace because I don't know how often it happens, but it happens often enough that most people who live in Bayview and maybe most people who live in Milwaukee have seen a truck stuck in the KK can opener. Why hasn't anything been done about it yet?
Well, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about, I believe when Tony Zielinski was still an alderman in Bayview, there was some talk about doing something or other. And I believe this was at a time when two trucks had gotten stuck under these bridges like in a week. I mean, it just kept happening. And if you look on YouTube, you can find all these news reports of the KK can opener striking again. And you can even look back as far as I found a video from 2007 that had a truck stuck under the bridge. I mean, that's like the early days of YouTube itself. So that's very impressive. So this has been going on a long, long time. As to why, you know, anything hasn't been done to stop this, I believe it has to do with the owners of the bridges, which is a Canadian Pacific Railroad. And so this is not a city thing. The city just can't be like, hey, we're going to raise these bridges because they don't own these bridges. But there is something, kind of a funny compromise that's happening in the near future, right in that same area as the KK can opener. There's the big Komatsu mining campus that's being built, and this is a huge, huge project. And what's happening with one of the bridges, in order for trucks to kind of come in and out of this area more easily and not get eaten, obviously, the Wisconsin DOT, Department of Transportation, is kicking in a bunch of money to help build this big Komatsu mining campus. And some of that money is going to lower a section of the road of Kinnickinnick Avenue. They're not heightening the bridge. They're not putting that up. They're lowering the road. So in theory, I guess, one of the KK can openers, you know, big feeding grounds may be taken out here. The height of both bridges, I believe, is 12 feet and 9 inches. And the legal height of trucks and semis can go as high as 13 feet and 6 inches. The bridges are clearly marked, but over the years, people have still just been trying to get under there and find out they can't. So apparently at least one of those bridges will have the clearance finally for trucks to get in and out without getting destroyed. So that's both very exciting and both a little sad. Even the KK can opener itself via its Facebook page has kind of weighed in. It had a recent post a few weeks ago saying, so it looks like Komatsu and the DOT is going to put me on a diet. Hopefully I'll get a few more big meals and I'll always be here. I've welcomed visitors to Bayview and residence home for more than 100 years. I'm not going anywhere. just not going to eat as much. Thanks to everyone who is concerned about me. And yes, count me among those who are concerned. I don't even live in Bayview, and I'm one of those people that even just kind of passing into Bayview, I've seen trucks stuck underneath it. That's just how often this happens.
Well, Matt Wild, thank you for sharing this unique piece of Milwaukee culture, I guess.
It's the kind of Milwaukee culture that I cherish the most. Just goofy, complete nonsense that brightens someone's day when someone mentions it.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, which recently featured a piece about the KK can opener's impending diet. He spoke with Lake Fexjoy Powers. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of the conversations this week on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, you can look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we examine a recent report of anti-Semitic incidents in 2020 released by the Milwaukee Jewish Federation. Plus, look at five things to do in Milwaukee neighborhoods this month in our regular series with Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.